May it please this court. My name is Lisa Brenner Freeman. I'm with the Colorado Attorney General's Office. I'm here today representing the Colorado Board of Real Estate Appraisers and the former director of the Division of Real Estate, Aaron Toll. The case before you is a Colorado Open Records Act case. More specifically, this appeal involves the application of three CORA exemptions: the investigative files exemption, the confidential financial information exemption, and the deliberative process privilege. All of the records at issue, except for one, which we believe is subject to the deliberative process privilege, are contained in the board's investigative files.
Which file that is somehow by some description, because I haven't been able to discern that from your briefs. I know you said that, but I don't know which file, which record it is.
The records at issue, except for one, all relate to the investigations of particular licensees. There are more than one licensees whose files are at issue, but all of the records contained are in the files related to the investigations of certain licensees.
Except one document you say is not covered by the investigative files, is covered by something else.
The deliberative process.
All right, which of those documents is that you're talking about? I know which five you assert the deliberative process with respect to. Which one of those is?
The one document, there are six records that we believe are subject to the deliberative process privilege. Five are in the board's investigative files, and so there are multiple exemptions covering those. The one that is not a part of the board's investigative files is an email communication from two members of the Division of Real Estate, Aaron Toll, the director,
and Marsha Walters, and from September of 2009, right?
I don't recall the date, but it is concerning prior CORA requests.
Oh, of the same plaintiffs, yes.
Yes.
Okay, I know what you're talking about now.
Yes.
Those were held to be subject to the attorney-client privilege, however, were they not?
Though that particular record was not subject to the attorney-client privilege, there was no attorney communication. There was another subset of records that the trial court found were subject to the attorney-client privilege, and those also related in part to the prior CORA.
I think I know what you're talking about. Okay, sorry.
I'd first like to speak to the investigative files exemption found at CRS section 2472-204-2A1. The key question for this court is whether this particular exemption applies to the board and other state agencies that perform similar investigative functions. The General Assembly gave state government the authority to determine whether a CORA request for investigative files should be denied based on their determination that disclosure would be contrary to the public interest. I'll quote from CRS section 2472-204-2A, which states, "The custodian may deny the right of inspection of the following records, unless otherwise provided by law, on the ground that disclosure to the applicant would be contrary to the public interest." And then 2A1 goes on to discuss investigative files. The trial court determined that only criminal law enforcement agencies have this discretionary authority to deny access to their investigative files. The seminal question on this appeal is whether the General Assembly intended to allot the same authority to civil law enforcement agencies, such as the board. The key statutory provision provides that the custodian may deny inspection of, quote, dot, 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 any investigative files complied for any other law enforcement purpose.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Let me ask a more basic question. The custodian under this provision has discretion to decide one way or the other.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because the word may starts this section.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
As part of today's discussion, I thought it would be helpful to go through how the board operates. The board begins an investigation based on a complaint which alleges some sort of wrongdoing. The board then commences an investigation. Investigators housed at the Division of Real Estate then interview the complainant and other witnesses. They can issue subpoenas and they perform other investigatory functions in a similar fashion as a police officer would investigate a potential crime. Once the investigation is complete, the division investigators then make recommendations to the board of real estate appraisers based on.
Can I ask another? Please. I'm asking basic questions. Does the do the investigators have subpoena power?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
Okay.
They then make recommendations to the board as to whether there have been any infractions of licensing laws. The board then renders a decision as to whether any licensing violations occurred, and if so, what the appropriate discipline should be. The matter then often is referred to the Office of the Attorney General, where the particular assistant attorney general assigned to the case ordinarily would file notice of charges. The licensee then would be entitled to a full-blown evidentiary hearing afforded by due process. Thereafter, a licensee has appeal rights at the agency level and then to this court.
You don't take the position that those are criminal sanctions, though, do you?
I do not, Your Honor.
Are they subject to fines?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if they're subject to a fine, what is it? what exactly is this procedure?
You know, that's a very interesting question.
That's why I asked it.
Thought about. You know, it isn't the normal day-to-day private litigant action for money damages. It is more than that. It is sort of a hybrid between that and the criminal process. A party is entitled to due process, but a point I'd like to make is that the same purposes underlying the application of this exemption to the criminal realm apply equally to the civil realm that we're discussing here today.
If there is subpoena power and authority to impose a fine, would you say this is quasi-criminal?
I think you can make that argument. I think I've never heard of it as being referred to as quasi-criminal. I think.
Are they subject to criminal prosecution? If there's some cases, perhaps, where the appraiser's done something so egregious, I suppose they could be subject to criminal prosecution.
You know, it is very well possible. The Board of Real Estate Appraisers does not have jurisdiction over criminal matters specifically. So this is more of a, you know, sort of a hybrid.
But they are subject to fines.
Yes. They are subject to fines and revocation of their license, possibly suspension, required education, other things. The General Assembly designed CORA to foster transparent government. But the General Assembly also provided exemptions from CORA where there were competing interests more important than government transparency, and the investigative files exemption is one of these situations. And to dovetail on my prior response, the same policy considerations for withholding investigative files from disclosure apply to both criminal and civil investigative files, such as the board's. One, the CORA investigative files exemption fosters an agency's ability to do its job, to investigate infractions of the law. This interest would be furthered by the exemption whether the records at issue be part of a criminal investigation or part of an investigation of a potential license law violation. CORA's investigative files exemption also protects investigatees' rights. These same types of individuals need protection whether the matter be criminal or related to a potential license law violation. The investigative files exemption also protects the rights of witnesses. Witnesses to criminal activity and witnesses regarding license law violations benefit similarly by the exemption. Government can compel disclosure of information from innocent third parties, while private citizens should not have the same ability.
Let me stop you. I understand the policies you're articulating behind taking a broader interpretation, but what about the language itself? I mean, the language of the statute itself, do you take the position that it's ambiguous and that we can look beyond the language of the statute, we can look at the legislative history, we can look at the policy, or is the language itself all that we have to go by?
Well, I would say that the language itself is difficult.
Does that mean ambiguous or
not?
The answer was ambiguous. This answer.
I would posture that any other law enforcement purpose is not ambiguous. It doesn't say criminal law enforcement purpose. It simply says law enforcement purpose. And to me, that includes both civil and criminal.
And then I have to ask you this. Let's assume it's not limited to criminal, even though the first two clauses clearly seem to be related to criminal.
I agree.
Where then, how do we redefine it? Where do we draw the line? What is law enforcement purposes limited to? Well, it's not this Department of Agriculture investigating the price of sugar beets, I assume. That's not the kind of thing. That might be law enforcement, but it's probably not covered by this.
I think a fair line to be drawn is investigations of license law violations. I think there are multiple types of licensing agencies, medical, dental, real estate related. And I think that is a fair line to be drawn where there is an investigation. There is a full-blown evidentiary hearing that's afforded a licensee by due process.
Investigation for license, possible license revocation violations, you would say, is part of the law enforcement purpose.
Yes, and as you pointed out, the imposition of fines and other sanctions. But I think where there is some sort of license law investigation, and a party's entitled to a full-blown evidentiary hearing, and their charges brought, notice of charges are brought, they're entitled to appeal rights before this court. I think that's a fair line to draw law enforcement purpose at.
Does the legislative history help us here at all?
I don't think so. We didn't cite it in our brief because we didn't find that it was very helpful.
They took this exemption out in the first place, put it over there in the Criminal Records Act, took it out of the Criminal Records Act, put it back into this one. You don't think that sheds any light on the legislature's intent?
Well, I do. And the legislature didn't take it out of the CJRA and put it back. It left the exemption, the investigative files exemption in the CJRA.
It's for criminal justice records.
Yes, it's there today. And mm-hmm. then they put another exemption back into CORA, I think, to cover investigative files, such as what we're talking about today. Can you imagine if any person at any time can demand disclosure of anyone's investigative files without having to say any purpose for it, and that being the intent of the legislature, even if it's an ongoing investigation, I submit that I don't think so.
How do they use these words then? Sheriff, District Attorney, Police Department, Sheriff, District Attorney, Police Department. They use it in the first two clauses, and then they leave it out of the third clause. What do you make of that?
I think the third clause lacks that particular phrase because they have a broader scope. I think the first two talk about the types of agencies, and the third then focuses on purpose, the law enforcement purpose. And so I think they wanted to broaden the scope of it and encompass things like my client's files.
I don't want to interrupt you anymore, but I have to ask you another question. Let's go to the deliberative process exemption because you're running out of time. I need to know this. Are the documents that you are saying the deliberative process attaches to documents that were obtained by subpoena power or by, I'm sorry, the confidential information, excuse me, the documents with respect to which you say the confidential information attaches to?
Were they obtained
by subpoena or were they obtained voluntarily?
Both. I think the records are both. I think some were obtained via subpoena and some were obtained otherwise.
Which are which? How are we supposed to know?
As far as all of the records that are at issue in this case?
Well, my problem is this. Confidential information requires that the agency make a showing that your ability to obtain the information in the future will be impeded. As the district judge said, if you can subpoena the documents, it shouldn't be impeded. If the documents were subpoenaed, I don't see why the confidential information, how that prong would be satisfied, as I understand what the district court said. But I don't know which documents are which. So even if we were to try to apply your analysis, I don't know how we would know which documents were subpoenaed and which documents were voluntarily applied. We can't tell from the record, I don't think.
That I can't tell you here today, but I would submit that test, the test that's been used in the bidding situations, is not really applicable in this particular matter. This is third-party tax information that this party obtains to use to get state tax credits, federal tax credits. It was not generated by the agency. It was voluntarily or involuntarily submitted. Even if there is a subpoena, that doesn't mean people are going to be necessarily willing, although they should be. It has the force of law. I think there are broader implications. And an agency does a lot of its investigation without subpoenas. Most investigations occur without subpoenas. It's talking to people. It's trying to fact find, figure out what's going on. That, you know, if you don't even know where to start to ask in a subpoena, you've got to do some legwork. You got to go on the ground and ask questions where a subpoena and subpoena power wouldn't help you under those circumstances. I'd just like to discuss that the board has relied on this investigatory files exemption for a long time, and the board is one of numerous state agencies and commissions who regulate licensure and must do these kinds of investigations. I submit that this court's decision will have a significant impact on many state entities regulating licensure, their licensees, and the people of the state of Colorado who cooperate with investigations. And if this court is so willing, I would love to have a few minutes for rebuttal if possible.
Oh, you're actually out of time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark McDonald. I'm here on behalf of Landowners United. And we are here requesting that this court affirm the trial court's decision in this matter. Judge Rappaport issued a 25-page, well-written, and well-reasoned order. In each and every instance, the trial court set forth the appropriate legal standards, applied the facts to those standards, the facts which are well supported by the record in this case, and correctly determined that the state defendants wrongfully withheld documents from inspection pursuant to the Colorado Open Records Act. It is our position that the defendants have not set forth any compelling rationale for this court to reverse that order. And like counsel for the state, I believe the initial place for this court to focus is the investigatory files exemption and the state's claim. And essentially, the state is going to have to prove that the trial court's three bases for allowing inspection were improperly granted, each of those three bases. Those bases first includes Berea's statute, second includes an analysis of the investigative files exemption itself, and third stated that it would be an abuse of the trial court's discretion to withhold the records given the fact that there had been a passage of time since the appraisal discipline had occurred and that the investigatory files themselves had been turned over to the appraisers in this particular case. The one thing that I would ask the court to focus on principally is Berea's own enabling statute. That statute would suggest that both from the investigatory files and the deliberative process privilege, the state's enabling statute would suggest that those do not apply and that the court should have allowed inspection as it did. In this case, I would point the court specifically to two particular provisions of the enabling statute, 12-61-704, subpart 1C1 provides that the board has the power to keep all records of proceedings and activities that the board has conducted. And it says, it concludes, which records shall, mandatory, shall be open to the public inspection at such time and in such manner as may be prescribed by the rules and regulations formulated by the board.
Does that mean they could have adopted rules and regulations that these records not be disclosed? Could they have adopted a regulation that their investigative files are not open to the public or the names of confidential informants are not open to the public?
You know, the agencies are required by law to follow their enabling statutes. Adams versus Social Services was cited in our brief for that proposition. I don't believe that the mandatory disclosure that's required by this section would control. I would state, Judge Richmond, that what's talking about there is the manner in which the request can be made, the times in which somebody can go and inspect those records. I don't believe that the agency would have had the authority to overrule the clearly expressed intent of the legislature regarding open records in this case. Under 12-61-710, It's even more specific in terms of the requirements on BEREA regarding records, and that speaks specifically to complaints of record in the office and the investigatory files that are part of those complaints. And except in two extremely limited circumstances, it is stated that those records are public records.
No, what it says is the records shall be closed, is what it says, and then you imply from that that until a certain point in time, and then they should be open. It's an implication, though, isn't it, Mr.
McDonald? It is an implication, and read in harmony with 704, I think it's obvious. It's an obvious implication and a clear implication. So when we read 704 that says the records of the agency shall be open to inspection, and then we read 710 that says they are closed in two instances. I think the obvious implication of the legislature there is that except in those two cases, the investigative files of the agency are in fact open to public inspection.
But then it goes on to say subject to the provisions of CORA.
It does.
It expressly says that. That's not an implication.
No, and it does expressly state that. And
so then doesn't the reader then have to go over to CORA and see, it's okay, let's assume you're right. It has to be disclosed by implication. It expressly says go to CORA. We go to CORA and then we apply CORA.
Correct. And CORA, both 204-2A and 204-3A state, the 2A talks about the permissive exemptions. And 3A talks about the mandatory exemptions. Both of them clearly state that those exemptions apply except as otherwise provided by law.
So we go back to the real estate.
Correct.
And that's as we go back, it's circular.
Well,
we don't get
you. In that particular case, really what you have is you have the specific over the general. So, and the specific, the agency is mandatorily obligated to follow its enabling legislation. And if you read 704 and if you read 710, it's clear that there was a legislative intent expressed that these records would be available to the public. And there's other provisions within the BEREA statute that also suggest the same thing. And the court has touched on some of them. They have the power to subpoena records. The legislature has given complainants and witnesses to investigations, extremely broad immunities that apply not only to civil liability, but also criminal liability. The legislature has expressed through the totality of the BEREA statute a legislative scheme that makes it possible for the agency to conduct the investigation and yet have those records open to the public except in the two limited instances set forth in 710.
How does that protect the witnesses that the board is talking about, or the I don't want to say informants, complainants? How are they protected? Just because the board members have immunity doesn't protect them.
Well, number one, all right, excuse me, yeah. did I finish? All right. The witnesses specifically, and this is in 710, are given broad civil and criminal exemption from liability. And that is in 710 subpart 8, and it states as follows. Any person participating in good faith in making of a complaint of record or participating in any investigative or administrative proceedings before the board pursuant to this article shall be immune from any liability, civil or criminal, that otherwise might result by reason of such action. So that's an extremely broad grant of immunity for these persons.
But what about things like injury to their reputation, hurting their business relationships with the person, the kind of things that the board is talking about? I mean, there is some argument that confidentiality of those relationships should also be protected, and that's not protected by the UNI.
I guess what I would point to the court there is the primary persons who are involved in the investigation are the appraisers. And in each of these instances, because we're essentially talking about two appraisers, they were provided copies of the investigative files. I mean, the persons who are subject to the complaints already know and are free to share it with anybody else. The other thing I would point to the court, and I think this is a really important point, is the agency itself recognized its own legislative mandate. And if the court will review the Malinsky stipulation and order that was entered here, that particular order provides, and it's an order of the board, that the investigative file is open to public inspection, is a public record, is what
it
states.
Where does it provide that? I read that yesterday. I didn't see that in there. I'm sorry. You also suggest, by the way, while we're on it, that it actually incorporated the investigative report, and I didn't see that in there either. Not the words.
That was the Stroh.
Oh, excuse me.
The Malinsky one did not incorporate, but the Stroh stipulation for probation clearly indicated that it incorporated the investigative files. It's not the order of summary suspension, it's the other order. The order, and I believe it's paragraph 9.
This is the Stroh?
This is Malinsky.
Malinsky, okay.
I had highlighted it on my copy. Okay, it is in paragraph 9B response, and this is in, this was exhibit A, and the exhibits don't have reference. I can't make reference to the transcript or the record because they were sent over late. So the exhibits are separate, but it states, respondent acknowledges that the board will publish the stipulation in final agency order on the board's website and in the appraiser's update, a board publication, and will treat the stipulation and final agency order and the investigative report as public records in the custody of the board. So when the board had an opportunity prior to any CORA request being made, they clearly recognized the legislative mandate that it was the duty of the agency to make this a public record.
That stipulation, it's not in the Stroh one. It's not in the Stroh report.
That is not in the Stroh one. In the Stroh one, though, and Stroh does specifically incorporate the investigative report into the decision, which is obviously relevant under the confidential files exemption. So unless the state agencies get by their own enabling statutes, we don't even really get to analysis under the CORA exemptions themselves. This court does not have to address whether CORA actually applies to civil enforcement agencies in this case. The court can make the clear reading under Berea, but if the court does find that the Berea statute is not applicable, it's the position of landowners that the trial court correctly held that that the investigatory files exemption wasn't applicable. The trial court set forth the legal maxim expressio unius est exclusio alterius. Basically, the expression of one thing is the exclusion of other things. And in this case, the statute, and we're talking about the investigatory files under 2A1 of 704, under 204, clearly sets forth the type of agencies for which that applies. And those agencies are sheriff's departments, prosecuting attorneys, police departments, in both the first clause and the second clause.
But let me ask you this. If you went to the trouble to draft the statute and you put the phrase sheriff, prosecuting attorney, or police department in clause 1,
yes.
Sheriff, prosecuting attorney, or police department in clause 2, and you meant it to be in clause 3, why didn't you put it there?
I think what was being expressed there, Judge Richman, was the legislative intent that it apply to other law enforcement agencies that enforce the criminal laws of the state of Colorado. And there are...
And wouldn't they have just said criminal? It uses any seems a pretty broad net.
Yeah, and you know, the legislature has done that frequently. I mean, the legislature did that with respect to the jury selection statutes. And in that case, that's the People versus Ma analysis. So this phrase, any other law enforcement agency, is sprinkled fairly liberally through the statute and is generally, at least as far as I've been able to tell, has been defined as agencies that enforce the criminal laws of the state of Colorado, and we set that forth in our brief. Yes, sir.
This exemption got back in here in 1988 when they took it out of the criminal justice. If the records of for criminal justice are already protected in the, whatever it's called, the CCRJA, why is there also an exemption in the Open Records Act?
Yeah, and that is an excellent question.
Thank you.
An issue that the court, and I think, you know, why would it include specifically sheriffs, prosecuting attorney, and other police departments? I would point the court to the legislative history. I think that's the only way that the court can really make a determination. And when the Criminal Justice Records Act was adopted, it took out the law enforcement or the investigatory files. It was later put back in, and it was specifically put back in. It was put back in a law that dealt with criminal justice records.
Sealing.
Exactly. And what we've surmised, and I think it's a reasonable surmise, is that there are circumstances under which these records can end up in other persons' hands. A mayor of a city could easily end up with law enforcement files in a personnel matter. The county commissioners could easily end up with records in a civil liability matter. And with the sealing of records, it makes sense. Otherwise, this re-enactment doesn't make sense.
See, you're out of time.
I just have to ask one question. I'm sorry. The judge in the end said that certain documents are protected by the attorney-client privilege, even though they're not protected by the deliberative process. I don't see a cross-appeal from you. I take it that we don't need to address those documents.
That is correct.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.